From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. A new report from California Watch, that's a project of the Center for Investigative Reporting in collaboration with KQED, shows that class size is going up in California. Two-thirds of the state's largest school districts, including San Jose and Mount Diablo School District, are squeezing more kids into the classroom. The reason, of course, is cash, but the consequence is less clear. In the hour ahead, we'll dig into what we know about how class size impacts education and what schools should do to focus their scant resources during these tough times. Cash, kids, and class size. Ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. There are any number of state services being squeezed by California's ongoing budget woes, but when it comes to the state's schools, the squeeze is literal. That's because many schools around the state are now packing more kids into classrooms. A new report by California Watch, which is a team of reporters out of the Center for Investigative Reporting working in collaboration with KQED, that new report indicates that two-thirds of the state's largest school districts are boosting the size of their classes. Reducing class size in grades K through 3 was a celebrated reform put in place 13 years ago, so that now that class sizes are rising again, we want to look at what the impact of that will be on kids and on education, and also whether or not during this time of tight dollars, what schools can do to get the most out of their limited resources. Those are the questions we'll tackle on this hour of Forum. Joining us, Louis Friedberg. He directs the California Watch reporting team for the Center for Investigative Reporting that looked into this issue. Louis, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Norton Grubb joins us as well. He's professor of policy, organization, measurement, and evaluation at the University of California's School of Education. He's also the author of the book, The Money Myth. Professor Grubb, thanks for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Camille Haroldson is a teacher at Watsonville Elementary School. She'll be joining us in just a moment. She's experiencing this class size increase, and we want to get her perspective on this. She'll join us in just a bit. But here with us now is Sheila Jordan. She's Alameda County Superintendent of Schools. Those are a large school district that includes some 11,000 teachers and 400 schools, and where schools in both Oakland and Hayward in particular have had to increase class size. Superintendent Jordan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, Louis Friedberg, start us out. You took a look at the largest school districts in the state, the top 30 districts or so, and found that two-thirds of them were increasing class size. In the Bay Area, what school districts in particular seem challenged by having to increase their class sizes to a substantial degree?
Well, the two school districts that really stood out were the San Jose Unified School District, which has increased all K-3 classes to 30 students. And the Mount Diablo Unified School District, which is near Concord, which has also increased students to 30 students. And that's about the maximum permitted by state law. I think you can go a little bit higher, but that's about the maximum. So that's just a huge increase from the 20 limits that the state was trying to get most school districts to adopt. And in fact, until very recently did.
And as you've done this research and reporting work, Louis Friedberg from California Watch, what did you hear in those districts in particular? Give us some sense of the sort of feeling that you were getting, both from teachers and administrators, about the impact that that was having on their schools.
Well, let me say this. I mean, one of the things that I think to many people it is disturbing that this huge program that California introduced 13 years ago, and it actually the state has spent $22 billion, just the money that's come directly from Sacramento, that is spent on this program is now kind of being unraveled across the state. But what I think most people don't realize is that class size is like one of the last things that districts want to do. And often they have to take these measures after they've made many, many other deep cuts in virtually every other program. And then it comes down to this class size reduction issue. which is a very expensive program to maintain.
We'll get into the costs involved and whether or not it is money well spent as we progress throughout this hour. But Superintendent Jordan, from your perspective in the Alameda County Schools, give us a sense of what's going on, particularly perhaps in an urban district like Oakland that's having to boost class size. What you're hearing from people on the ground, building principals, classroom teachers, about the impact that they feel this is having on the kind of education that they're able to provide their kids.
Well, actually, you know, Oakland has not raised its class size significantly as of now. Hayward has, and Fremont has. Part of it is that what we're seeing is that almost 40% of our districts have raised class sizes, but most of them have gone from 20 to 24 because the state is allowing established three different tiers. Only Fremont and Hayward have taken CSR off the table, and they do that.
CSR, sorry, just to interject, class size reduction. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's a professional liability.
Talking That's okay.
With code. Those are the only ones this year who are taking class size off the table. It is a last resort, and people don't want to do it, but it does take money from general fund. And for those districts that are tremendously strapped, they have no other alternatives. All other cuts have been made. Now, one reason why places like Oakland and Berkeley and Piedmont and Albany are able to stay steady is because of the local taxes. They have, you know, there is Oakland, the wonderful citizens of Oakland, California, have never turned down a parcel tax that's come before them. And so they are moving forward, and they also have a little flexibility because they're drawing down the last of their loan. So Oakland is not out of trouble, nor are any of the other districts, really, because the other thing that's going on this year is sort of the artificial infusion of money from the federal stimulus funds. When that money goes away, the fiscal crisis management team, which is the state fiscal advisor, they are estimating that up to 50% of districts statewide could be in absolute trouble.
Let's get the perspective of a classroom teacher on how this feels at the ground level. Camille Haraldson joins us. She's a third-grade teacher at H.A. Hyde Elementary School in Watsonville, where her class has grown from 20 to 30 this year. Talk to us about what difference that has made this year, Camille Haraldson.
Right. So going from 20 to 30 students, that's a 50% increase. And especially at the beginning of the year, it felt like 50% more work from the daily grading papers to report cards and reading essays. It's crowded. It's overwhelming. Generally, just a huge strain and a big change from my seventh year teaching from 20 years each to jump up to 30.
Can you say from your own individual experience pretty definitively that you feel the kids in your classroom this year are not getting the kind of education that kids in your classroom last year did?
Yeah, definitely, especially in the first few months of transition to rework everything that I do that has really been for 20 students. And with 30 students, I'm spending a lot of my prep time where I have the time to create real quality lessons, just doing logistical things that just take more time. So, on an individual basis, I have less time to spend with students, less time to spend with small groups, and the small groups are bigger groups. So I don't see how they can get the same education.
Camille Haraldson, a third-grade teacher, joining us from H.A. Hyde Elementary School in Watsonville. Norton Grubb is with us as well. He's a professor at the University of California's School of Education. And Professor Grubb, You can hear the difference that it's making in individual classrooms, and we know how popular the class size reduction effort has been in California over the last 13 years. But research on this question seems rather mixed. There have been some experiences in states like Tennessee and Wisconsin that point to reduced class size, making a difference for certain kinds of students, particularly in low-income areas. But it doesn't seem like there's a consensus view on that, even though the anecdotal experience seems to be quite positive. Can you just give us a quick sense of what we know and what we don't know about the effect of class size?
Sure, although it's not all that quick. I mean, first of all, no one likes large classes. Before I became an academic, I was a sixth grade teacher in Baltimore with a class of 40 sixth graders.
Wow.
It was a handful. And as a new teacher, I really didn't know what I was doing anyway, so having a large class made that worse. Aside from the fact that it's not pleasant to have larger classes, and no one really likes to have larger classes, least of all me, the evidence is mixed on whether it actually affects learning outcomes. And in California, the experiment that you refer to, the $22 billion experiment, was in fact evaluated in the early years, in about 2002, by a couple of people from RAND. And they found that on the average, class size reduction had made no difference for an interesting reason. In a lot of schools, they had to turn to emergency credential teachers in order to get enough teachers, so that the quality of the teachers were being degraded as class sizes were being reduced. Secondly, a lot of classes had to meet in undesirable spaces, you know, in broom closets, in auditoriums, in the lunchroom, and so forth, so that they were in distracting places. And I think most important of all, there wasn't very much money put into professional development for teachers so that they would teach in different ways. And I'm going to point out that if you're basically lecturing to students, which is not what Camille described herself doing, by the way, but if you're basically lecturing to students, it doesn't matter whether you have four students or 40 or 400. So one of the problems with class size reduction is that many teachers go on teaching in conventional ways. So the resource that you really need is what I call a compound resource. You need class size reduction, and you need to keep the quality of teachers up, and you need professional development so they teach in different ways, and you have to have adequate physical facilities.
So would it make sense in some ways if this effort were to continue, let's say California solves somehow its giant fiscal problems and there is an ability to keep class sizes small again, to target it, to make sure that it's aimed at perhaps urban areas, to make sure that those areas, lower income school districts, are the recipient of this, to make those schools, among other things, attractive so that you get good teachers, focus the effort, focus training in that regard? Is that a class size reduction effort that would make more sense?
Sure, particularly with the professional development to make sure teachers teach in different ways. I think that the class size reduction was a windfall for a lot of suburban schools. They were able to get money to reduce class size. They were able to attract teachers. They had enough space. So they were the ones that benefited.
Yeah.
But, of course, the great need is in our urban schools.
Superintendent Jordan, would you concur with that, that we need to make this a more targeted effort so that schools like the Oakland schools, Hayward schools in your kind of county, would benefit more and become more attractive to teachers because they would have these small classes?
Well, I agree with every single thing that Norton Grubb said, that it's a comprehensive approach. And in the early years, we moved into class size reduction very quickly. It passed, the money was put forward, and then the districts had to scramble to put those classes together. So doing the research on those first early years would not show the same results, I think, that we're seeing today.
Uh-huh.
And I do want to remind folks that there's also a lot of new research on the importance of preschool and early childhood development. So, you know, these are making gains with children and reaching children at every level individually so that everyone can live up to their potential. Those early years are critical, and the lower class size reduction is a targeted program, and I think it would be a mistake to say, oh, in the suburban schools, they really don't need it. Because, you know, actually, if you go into more affluent communities, there are many children who have special needs and who benefit from smaller class size. And truthfully, we're a large state. If we start saying it's just for urbans, we won't keep it.
Yeah. Louis Friedberg, as you have reported on this, one of the interesting things I read in the story that you put together was that some superintendents are not necessarily, though, that enamored with this being priority one. In other words, you quoted Don Iglesias, the superintendent in San Jose, saying, you know, actually, I'd like to use this money to extend the school year or to have classes on Saturday. So what did you learn in your reporting on this about how superintendents in various districts around the state see the need for money to go?
Yeah, and could I just clarify? In Fremont, the Fremont schools, they have raised class sizes in the kindergarten class, but they've been able to preserve it so far in the first to third grades. And you know, I think just to respond to what Norton Grubb was saying, I think the notion now that we'd somehow be able to go back and reinstate class size reduction or these smaller class sizes to districts around the state, I think is really unrealistic. What we're facing now, I'm not suggesting Norton was suggesting that would happen right away, but the notion, what we're facing now is that all the other school districts that have been able to maintain class size are really fearful that in the next year or two or three, they're going to have to increase class size as well. I think what this crisis has done, and I'm not suggesting this is a good thing, but it has put on the table where California should be spending its money. I mean, this class size reduction program has been enormously expensive. It's costing the state $1.8 billion this year. And then the research is equivocal about what impact it has. So I think it does allow educators around the state to have a discussion. Do we want to put money into this, into smaller class sizes? Do we want to put money into Saturday school, the longer school days, or dropout prevention programs? But I think before one moves away from class size, from these smaller class sizes wholesale across the state, I think one has to be pretty sure that whatever direction one moves in is actually going to have the payoff that the state wants.
And of course, one of the ironies is that California has not evaluated this since, as I understand it, those early evaluations that RAND did back in 2002 or 3. So it may well be true, as Superintendent Jordan is suggesting, that it is making a difference, but we don't really know that. So we're back in some ways to the anecdotal experience. So Camille Haroldson, from that point of view, as we talk about in this time of tough dollars, where money most needs to go, as a classroom teacher, as someone who's now dealing with 30 kids in her third grade classroom, Is that what would make the most difference to you as someone on the ground to have fewer kids? Is it really that basic?
Absolutely it is. I think that's where our priorities need to be is, you know, the rally cry, keep the cuts away from the classroom. And that is the biggest impact is class size. And right, and in an ideal world, we have all those compound resources of the well-educated or well-trained teachers and the facilities and everything, that really, that is the top priority. That is the best way I can see making a difference with all these other resources involved.
The contrary argument, Camille Haroldson, I'd like your opinion on this, and we'll hear also from our other guests, is that you'd rather have a good teacher with 30 students than a not-so-great teacher with 20 students. That in the end, what makes the most difference isn't so much the number of bodies in the classroom, but the body that's leading the classroom. What's your response to that argument?
It does seem like that's comparing apples and oranges, or you're comparing two different things. I mean, ideally, we want a good teacher
sure.
with fewer students. And if those were pitted against each other, yeah, it's hard to argue for a smaller class size reduction. But we're shooting for the ideal, right?
Well, but that really gets at the heart of it, I think, in some ways, because while that may be the ideal, we all know California is a long ways from being the ideal. So, Norton Grubb, if you were empowered to focus where our dollars go, and then Sheila Jordan, I'd like your thoughts on this too. What does make the difference? Do we know that it is teacher training, that effective teachers in the end make more difference than the number of kids in a classroom? Norton Grubb?
comments about this. I want to make two comments about it, but first I want to point out something that's missing in the debate.
Yeah.
And that is that when we think about class size reduction, we think about the effect on kids' learning and their test scores. But one of the terrible consequences of increasing class size is that there are fewer adults around schools. And in my statistical work, one of the things that makes a big difference is not class size, but the number of adults per student in schools. That is a dimension of personalization that's really quite important. And as we have cut out librarians, as we've cut out guidance counselors, as we've, starting to increase class size, the number of adults who are around to educate kids in a broader sense has been going down, and that's not a good thing. It doesn't show up in test scores. What it shows up in is progress through school. My work is on high school, and it shows up in the rate at which kids accumulate credits and move towards graduation and so forth. So I'm afraid that we're missing a big side of the picture when we focus on test scores, because kids' attachment to school, their commitment to schooling, their ability to get through schooling in a straightforward way are all being compromised by this. Another kind of problem over a long period of time, over the 30 years that we've been degrading schools in California, is that teachers are just exhausted. I run a program for principals called the Principal Leadership Institute, and when my aspiring principals try to engage in reforms in their school, they have a very hard time getting the time and attention of teachers because they have so many burdens on them. So a big cost of increasing class size will be, again, that teachers will be even more exhausted, and their ability to engage in reform is going to be dissipated. And I think that those are costs that we need to reckon when we think about class size and not just think about it in terms of learning outcomes. In terms of what's really effective, I think that there's two things that are effective that don't cost very much money, and that is you can show that schools that have more money don't in fact get more of them. One is the quality of teaching, but I want to be really specific about that. What that means is what teachers do in classrooms and their ability to move away from rote drill and kill, as it's sometimes called, and information transfer to more conceptual ways of teaching. There's a lot of evidence that these more conceptual, or as educators call them, constructivist forms of teaching are much more effective. Doing that requires either teacher training that's much longer than we have in California, or in-service training, professional development, that is quite different from what most schools do. So one place I would put my efforts is in trying to change the nature of teaching in the schools from kindergarten up through 12th grade. And a second area where, again, that again makes a great deal of difference is the climate of a school and the culture of a school. We have too many schools where the relationships among students and between students and teachers are pretty poor. Working on that requires not a lot of money, but it certainly requires leadership from principals, cooperation from teachers, and a school-wide effort to change the norms and values of a school.
Let me hold you there. We have to take a break. And when we come back, we'll take your calls on this subject and try to dig into this more, the kinds of things that Norton Grubb was just talking about. How do we improve quality of teaching? How do we keep teachers from being exhausted? What are the kinds of things we need to do if we're going to improve California schools during these difficult times? Here's the number if you want to join in our conversation. If you're a parent, teacher, student, we'd love to hear from you. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Back with more in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, increases in class size around the state of California. That's what a new report found, conducted by the Center for Investigative Reporting, a reporting team, the California Watch, led by Louis Friedberg, found out. We're taking a look at that topic this morning and hearing from a variety of people about their perspectives on it. And we'd like your perspective as well. Again, the number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Lots of calls coming in. We'll get to them in one moment. But a brief response first from Camille Haraldson to the kind of thing that Norton Grubb was saying, Camille, about the need for training in particular to help teachers be quality teachers, but also this exhaustion factor, because it seems to me if you're exhausted, as I suspect you are, attending more training is probably the last thing you want to do.
Right. And my training is in more of the constructive style that Norton Grubb referred to, fortunately. And because I'm so exhausted and just dealing with the logistics of modifying my classroom to 30, I've moved away from that more interactive, exploratory learning where kids work in with groups and more towards the rote learning, lecturing, just out of survival.
And Superintendent Jordan, is that what you're seeing as well, that with every intention and desire, of course, that good teachers have to want to do the kinds of things that Norton Grubb is discussing, that the numbers involved make that much more complex? I happen to have some good friends who are teachers, and they're all exhausted. So how do you contend with the need everyone would agree to do in terms of training and improvements,
well,
given that situation?
First of all, I want to mention that education is a people business. So when we are forced to cut the way we're being forced to cut right now, it means that we are eliminating adults in education at every level, and each of those adults are very important. It used to be that I've been working with public health on H1N1, and they said, well, you know, the school nurse should make an assessment. Well, we haven't seen school nurses in a decade. Each of those adults plays an important role. We just graduated 30 students mid-year from juvenile hall. What did each of those students stood up? Each of them had been in trouble, and they said, thank you to our teachers. Thank you to those people who have supported us. We were in trouble. We were failing, and here we are getting our degree. I mean, students will articulate what a good teacher means for them. Yes, teachers are exhausted, but they're more... They're exhausted, but it's amazing how they persevere. Just like we hear from Camille, who's working double time, and she does have the training. It's not like we've been standing still. We've seen a lot of improvement in the last decade, working on parent involvement, working on using smaller environments effectively, breaking large high schools down to family-sized units where people can individualize and utilize the potential adults in their environment. We cannot continue to keep cutting. Yes, we need to prioritize, but if we try and if we ask teachers to keep cutting, it's going to take, and it is taking, an impact. I just want to mention that that teacher engagement leads to student engagement. And we are working in Alameda County with a number of districts on a teacher action research project where they're looking at how to incorporate arts across the curriculum. It just so happens the grade level we're working on is in one district, we see it as this big blip only in that grade. And I think it's less about the arts, although, we know the arts encourages creativity and problem solving, and if you relate it to the curriculum involved, it engages students more. But it also has to do with teachers really thinking about their pedagogy and being directly involved.
Well, and probably also contributes to all of those climate issues that Norton Grubb was responding to as well. Norton Grubb, I'd love to get your two cents on the kinds of things we're discussing. But let's hear from some of our listeners first, and then I'll come back to you. Kay in Petaluma joins us first. Kay, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Thanks for letting me on the show.
Yep.
As a parent and a teacher myself, I have very strong feelings about public education. And I just wanted to comment that, the class size reduction is just one, of many aspects of what goes into good public schooling. And I guess the debate's going to go on and on because there's, you know, there's two sides to it. But I'm just wondering, if class size reduction isn't important, to me it seems like common sense. The fewer kids you have in a classroom, the more time they're going to get one-on-one with the teacher, the better the job the teacher can do understanding the needs of that particular student. And I think the proof of that is that private schools, when they're advertising their programs, they boast smaller class sizes, whether it's elementary, secondary, or colleges. And to me, it just seems like it shouldn't be called a program. We call this the class size reduction program. It should be policy. We should have smaller classrooms. We should have smaller schools. I don't know
yeah.
why we have to have it measured by, you know, in some scientific manner when it just seems like common sense to me.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the call. Nirngrub, there are a lot of shoulds in all of this. You know, we talk about we should have smaller classes. We should have smaller schools. We should be able to provide teachers with the kind of training and support that they need so they can engage in the kinds of ways that Camille Haraldson is trying to do in her classroom. So we have all these shoulds, but we're in a situation right now where one works against another. If we have all of these forces on teachers right now where they are exhausted, how do you do training in that circumstance? Help us work through that conundrum.
Well, there's no good solution to that conundrum. I think we have to say forthrightly that the state of California is a failed state and that it has eroded schools over 30 years. It's been a long process and there's a lot of blame to go around, but if we don't reverse it by making some kind of pledge or what we sometimes call in higher ed a master plan to lead us over 30 years out of this wilderness, the kinds of trade-offs that you're talking about are just not going to work well because of what you just said. Every time you turn around, you're blocked by something else.
Yeah.
I do think that people do have to pay more attention to what research says because it is simply not true that the effects of class size are common sense. There was a very little-known piece of research about 20 years ago. People talk about Tennessee a lot, but there was a much better piece of research along the same lines. And what happened was, again, they reduced class sizes, and teachers did not, in fact, pay more attention to kids and did not, in fact, change their teaching, which is back to my point that we have to have smaller classes and the right kind of professional development for teaching because it doesn't happen by itself. And although it might seem obvious that it ought to happen by itself, it doesn't. So I think we need to pay a lot more attention to that. More generally, California has spent billions of dollars on programs that have not been effective. There was something called AB 1274. The Intermediate Intervention Underperforming Schools Program was very ineffective. The legislature didn't pay attention to that and reauthorized something called the High Priority School Grant Program that was ineffective, and we're doing the same thing now. We don't spend money in California well. The state wastes a lot of it at the same time that our schools really need more resources, and I think we need to look really hard at why that's true and what we as a state can do to reverse that.
And to Bill in San Jose, or rather to Bill in Menlo Park. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that a lot of times with these policies, you get unintended consequences. In the state of Connecticut, for instance, they had pretty low-paid teachers, and they decided the solution to that was to mandate automatic increases in teachers' pay over a several-year period. And they also funded education of young bright college students if those college students would commit to going into education. What the result of that was several fold. One is they had absolutely zero attrition of the current teachers, and so the old teachers that were unsatisfactory stayed. Teachers who had gone off to make children and families came back. There were no positions available for the young, bright teachers. So the young, bright teachers defaulted on all their college grants and loans, and that was one of the major factors that incurred a income tax in the state of Connecticut.
Bill, and, thanks. Yeah, no, thanks for the observation. It's a reminder that you can't just throw money, but in California, you actually need some money to throw. We just need to make sure we throw it at the right place, and I think that's the argument that Norton Grubb is making. But, Bill, thanks for the call and the observation and the reminder that we have to pay attention to how money is spent. We need money, but we have to pay attention to how. Bill, thank you. Bill in San Jose is next. Bill, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a high school teacher, and I can tell you the class size definitely does make a difference whether you're lecturing or anything else, and it's important to understand why. I mean, in college, you could have 100 students in a classroom, and it works fine. They're all learning. In K-12 school, however, the students are there against their will. So the more students you have in a classroom, the more resentful students you have in a classroom, and of course the resentful ones are going to act out. They're going to be discipline problems, and every minute that the teacher is dealing with the discipline problem is a minute that he's not teaching. If you want to solve this, what we have to do is make it easier for students who don't want to be there to leave. I think one way we could do that, one easy way, would be to get rid of the age limit on taking the GED. Any student who wants to take it, let them take the test, and if they pass, give them their high school diploma, let them leave. Another way that we could do it, I'm not sure there's much political will for it right now, but if we could repeal the truancy laws, let the students who really hate being there leave, and the ones who remain will get a much better education regardless of class size.
Bill, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observation and the ideas. On the sort of management issues that Bill was bringing up, Camille, do you find that to be true in the third grade, that you wind up spending more time just sort of dealing with non-teaching things just because there are that many more kids, there are that many more opportunities, I suppose, for problems and for trouble?
I do. There's always a certain amount of conflict resolution and, of course, discipline issues. So 50% more students, you have generally 50% more problems, as well as students with special needs. If you have, with a class of 22 special needs students and a class of 30, you probably have 6, and that's a lot of extra time that takes away from teaching.
Some of our listeners emailing in, Wendy writes, as a high school English teacher, the increasing number of students in each class means I am always exhausted. I have no free time. My students will be the losers because there's only so much time to do this kind of work and little time to give the individual attention to writing in class. Cannoli writes, I was pleased to hear someone make the observation on your program about the impact of having fewer adults available in the school community. For me, it was often an administrator, counselor, an aide, or an other adult that was the most influential and meaningful to me during my K through 12 years. And Vicky writes, one implication of class size increases that has not yet been touched on so far is that of the physical plant size. Classroom walls don't stretch to accommodate more students with more desks, tables, or resources. Teaching in the more effective, engaging, exploratory way you're talking about also requires the physical space and resources to enhance the work. Scott in Menlo Park is next. Scott, go ahead.
Hi there. My daughters go to a parochial school. And I can't remember what the amount that the state pays per student in public schools, but, you know, I guess it's about the same that I pay for each of my daughters, which is around $5,000, $6,000 a year. And we've got 30 kids in each class, and overall the school is hugely successful. It's very diversified. So I just thought this would maybe be a good opportunity to kind of compare these schools, public schools, maybe parochials, not the elite private schools, but just the parochial schools, and say, well, what's the difference here? We've got one that's having consistent success getting into, good public high schools and private high schools. And we've got public schools in the same boat now, it seems like. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something obvious.
No, Scott, thanks for the call. Yeah, Superintendent Jordan, go ahead.
Sure. You know, I spent a whole section of my life as a special education teacher in public schools. And it's interesting that the speaker raises the issue of private schools versus public. In public school, we need to encourage every child to stay in school, actually. And in Catholic schools, parochial schools, whatever you want to call private schools, don't. If a child is not fitting in, that child is asked to leave. And if the child has special needs, that child is often referred back to the public schools to deal with. I used to have many students who came into my classes because from the Catholic schools. So to the extent that you can enforce a homogeneity And private schools can do that because you have to, you know, you have to be able to demonstrate that you will make it in that school environment. That education then becomes a little less arduous, and class size becomes less important. But you know, Norton Grubb is completely correct, and we can point to any number of schools that were small before lower class size, but had a small number of students in their classes, where students were not learning, where teachers were not engaged, students were not engaged, and expectations were very low. So, yes, we need to change school climate. I think we've come a long way, even though we have faced a lot of cuts in education and public education. We have been engaged in looking at why some kids are failing and what we're doing around expectations and how we develop standards that everyone can meet.
Hang on, Norton Grubb. Yeah. Finish up, if you would. Sorry. Superintendent Jordan, go ahead.
I'm just saying we've made a lot of progress in these areas. What we can't do is just starve the beast and take away the adults from our environment, because we will send kids back onto the street. I think this notion that kids who don't want to be in school shouldn't be in school is not a great notion, because students do want to learn if they're engaged and if you meet them where they're at and if they feel that the adults in their life actually believe in them. And we see that all the time.
And Norton Grubb, just a brief rejoinder, if you would, and I want to get on to more calls, but go ahead.
Actually, this was Lewis Friedberg.
Oh, Lewis, sorry. Go ahead.
Now, I just wanted to point out that in terms of, you know, one of the unintended consequences of this focus on the early grades and all the money that went into reducing class size in the early grades is that class sizes went up at the high school and the middle school level. And although there was a ninth grade class size reduction program that has almost been eliminated all over the state, and what we're left with today is that if you look at student-teacher ratios, and this is all the teachers, kind of to Norton Grubb's point, all the credentialed teachers in the school, not just the classroom teachers, but the counselors, the art teachers, the music teachers, that California is 48th out of 50 states.
Right. Worst states are Arizona and Utah, right?
Right. And I think that's the issue that we have to address, that we have, you know, California deserves higher standards than that.
Yeah. So let me add a point to
Norton
Lou's,
Grubb.
Lou's point, and that is that there is this notion out there that if we only get the early grades and pre-kindergarten right, that everything will be right thereafter. I don't think that that's correct at all. I think that what needs to happen is throughout the trajectory of kids' schooling, they need the right kind of support. So this inoculation model, we give them small classes in K-3 and then let everything go to hell, so to speak, after that, is not a good way, particularly to have kids graduating from high school, which is crucial in this day and age.
So would you say...
I agree with Sheila Jordan, the notion of letting kids sort of go out of school because they don't like it is a bad idea because it's bad for them in the long run.
So if the only good out of this, as Lewis Friedberg was suggesting earlier, comes that we really start thinking more broadly about, all right, we've got limited dollars, where are they going to make the most difference? Your argument, Norton Grubb, it sounds like, would be, you know, maybe not class size reduction in the early grades because you pay too big a price later on, that we really should direct that at teacher training, at improving school climate, K-12, not just focus on K-3.
That's right. I think when you think about the capacities of schools and the capacity, the question of capacity has been drowned out by the noise about test scores and requiring schools to do more with less. When you think about capacities, there's a couple of crucial elements. One is the preparation of teachers. The second is the preparation of principals, because they are very often the leaders and the spark of vision in a school. And we haven't paid very much attention to either of those.
Back to our calls. Jennifer in Novato joins us next. Jennifer, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I actually sit on the school board here in Novato, and we grapple with these questions every year and almost had to cut class or increase class sizes due to budget cuts. unfortunately, our parcel tax, we avoided it. But I really want to emphasize, the question was raised about what's the top priority, and I will reiterate all the comments around quality. I think that class size reduction is a very emotionally charged topic. It gets the unions going, which gets the PTAs going, and yes, smaller classes are easier to manage, but I think we really need to engage with our unions because there's a lot of structural impediments to the kind of change that the speakers have been talking about. And I'm wondering what kind of efforts have been going on in that regard to work with the unions across the state to really change what's happening in the classroom.
Jennifer, thank you. It's a really important question. And one of this also speaks to is the way in which California may get some more money, because in the desire to get federal funds, the so-called race for the top funds, California has to look at some things that in the past unions have been opposed to, including tying teacher pay to performance standards, which has not been something that teacher unions have been enthusiastic about, but perhaps speak to some of the things that Norton Grubb and others are making about rewarding effective teachers. Louis Freeberg, can you enlighten us at all about where any of that stands at the state legislature and whether or not unions are becoming more receptive to changing that approach?
Yes, I think they are. I mean, they've been forced to. And right now, the legislature is considering a whole slew of legislation to make California eligible for these state funds, and the CTA, I think, has been much more receptive to this linking of some kind of test scores with performance evaluations. Although it's a very complicated thing.
Yeah. And Camille Haroldson, from a teacher's perspective, what's your sense within the profession? Is there more openness to that idea that we need to reward effective teachers more?
I think that idea is met with a lot of resistance, especially where I work, which is a low-performing school. The area I work in is generally the majority is on free or reduced lunch, and our test scores have been low. And It's actually quite offensive because I could move to a more affluent area where the schools have the test scores and get paid more. Does that mean I am a worse teacher because of where I work? And it's really quite offensive, and I think should be taken with a lot of critical thinking around that.
Well, we have more callers who want to get in, but I want to just spend a beat more on this. So just a quick thought, Norton Grubb, because this gets at the question, of course, of how you measure effectiveness.
Yeah.
And Camille is making the valid point that it shouldn't be tied just to test scores.
I want to make the point that these measures, these efforts to develop merit pay are so difficult, and tying them to test scores as distinct from observations in classes of what people do, tying them to test scores is an extremely bad idea. The tests that we have in California have not been developed to measure kids' progress over time. They're totally inappropriate for doing that. Furthermore, as Camille has just said, it is not true that value-added measures gets rid of the effects of family background. They're still there. And so all the teachers who will be teaching low-income kids will have low rankings on this. The teachers in suburban areas with high-income kids will have high rankings, and it will skew the resources in the state even more.
Can you evaluate? Can you reward effective teaching?
There have been merit pay plans in which a school, or I've seen this in community colleges as well, gets together and defines what good teaching should look like, and then has systems of observation to observe teachers and then rank them in some way and hand out merit pay to them. And what's great about that is it gets teachers involved in looking at each other's practice and trying to figure out what good teaching is. But to tie it to test scores in some simple-minded way is a ghastly idea and will just make schools worse in this state.
And to Jessica in Santa Rosa. Jessica, go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for letting me get on the show. I'm a student teacher currently, and I work at a school that is a sanctioned program improvement school. And I want to bring up a point that hasn't been talked about yet, which is the fact that California has an immense large number of English language learners. And I believe that is one of the leading causes for our education system failing. And I do not I mean, I'm going through a teacher preparation program right now, and they are excellent. I think that they are doing a wonderful job. But when you enter the classroom and there's students who only speak Spanish at home, only speak Spanish with their friends on weekends, they're not getting that academic language outside of the classroom, it is extremely difficult to get them to pass those tests, especially when the test questions are oftenly they're tricky, and especially for people who aren't fluent in a language, that, you know, automatically makes them slip through the cracks and fail. And so I think I have a class that there's 25 students in my freshman class, which is excellent, and then I have 34 in my sophomore class, and I can tell you it's night and day. And in my sophomore class, I have about eight students who are still English language learners, and it is so difficult to get to them,
Jessica,
and to prioritize them.
Yeah, Jessica, sorry to interject, but we're running short on time, and I take your point, and it's an important one that adds again to the complexity of the challenge that is before us. We just have a minute left, so let me get a closing thought or two if I can. I mean, it seems to me in this arena we like to point the finger a lot. Sometimes we point it at the legislature, but we don't always point it at ourselves and think about what it is that we as a state, as citizens, need to do to try to support our schools. So just a last quick thought, Superintendent Jordan, if you would, on what you'd like people to think about in terms of how we can make our schools better.
Well, I think your final. First, I do want to agree with a lot of the analysis that went forward on merit, on the whole issue of merit pay. But I do think there's a way of not just observation, but expanding our assessment to be more inclusive of teacher involvement. There are ways that people can contribute, as certainly parent involvement, adults involvement in the schools. We do a lot of parent training, because particularly if you're talking about English language learners, which the state has many of, involving parents, having them understand a little better what's going on in school and using them in the classrooms is very, very important. When kids come in at the very young grades, it's another reason why, of course, education has to continue K-12 or pre-K-12 onto community college.
Right.
But they need a strong foundation. And if the children are young and they are exposed to English, they will do much better when they reach high school.
And
if kids come in at the older age, they need support so that they don't spend time, they don't graduate being stupid, ignorant, not
understanding. Sorry to interject, Superintendent Jordan, but we have to leave it there. We're out of time. I thank you all so much for adding your perspective to this really important question. And a note that if you want to compare class sizes around the state and watch a video of teachers discussing their struggles on this topic, go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Thanks all very much to our guests and to our listeners for participating in this discussion this morning. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.